got a 3-week-old infant out here. How is a 3-week-old infant gonna be able to survive out here with no milk, no water?
These are the families who listened to the authorities, who followed direction, who believed in the government. They were told to go to the convention center. They did. These are law-abiding citizens who have been left behind. They did everything they were told. They are just left behind. There's nothing offered to them. No water, no ice, no sea rations, nothing for the last 4 days. It's getting very, very crazy in there and very dangerous. I don't want to sound negative against anybody or any official, but according to them, they're there on their own. There's no police, there's no authority. They've been behaving. They have not started any melees, any riots, nothing. They just want food and support. There's no hostility there, so they don't need to be bringing any guns or anything like that. They need support.
Tell them that we need to get out of here.
People are dying. They're dying. Babies are dying.
There's no support here. There's no foundation. There's no plan B, plan A. These people are very desperate. I saw two gentlemen die in front of me because of dehydration. The sanitation was unbelievable. The stench in there, it was unbelievable. Dead people around the walls of the convention center laying in the middle of the street in their dying chairs where they died right there in their lawn chair. They were just covered up in their wheelchair, covered up, laying there for dead. Babies, two babies dehydrated and died. I just tell you, I couldn't take it.
There's not too much you can say after you see that. It really just opens it up to the worst nightmare you can possibly imagine when you're sent to cover an assignment that you don't think should be maybe that bad, if I can say that. I've covered a lot of hurricanes because I live in Florida, so we kind of gather enough information and we have like a routine of how to cover a hurricane, how to go about it, how to be safe. I happen to be employed. I'm a freelance cameraman, but I'm employed by NBC. Out of Miami, and they understand the type of work that we do and how we work, so I get a lot of leverage in how to go about covering hurricanes. There's a lot of trust from the company when you do this kind of work, because the last thing they want you to do is get in harm's way or be somebody's pain while you're trying to cover this hurricane. You never know the magnitude of it until you're actually there and you see what happens the next day. So following Katrina across the state of Florida, we started in Homestead, Florida. So by the time I got to New Orleans, we were beat up from Katrina. And we had an idea of what Katrina was gonna be because it did touch South Florida, came across the state of Florida, went into the Gulf Stream, became a huge hurricane. And for years, everybody's been hearing about how if a major Cat 5, Category 5, or Category 4 hurricane would come in the area of the Gulf, that it would be devastating for several states, not just New Orleans, but several states that were bordering each other in that area. And throughout the years, we've made contact with FEMA, Red Cross, Hurricane Center, and I can't tell you how many people we know that are dealing behind the scenes when disaster is supposed to strike our country and they're supposed to do something about it. So we call these people and we tell them, this is where we're at, this is what we're gonna do, what do you guys think, where should we be? And as we're crossing the state to go into New Orleans, these folks that I normally rely for information in the state of Florida, because there's a east side, Midwest, and then the west, of FEMA and Red Cross, or different districts. So I'm usually working with the east side, the east coast, up all the way up to New York and all the way down to Key West. And these have people I've worked with and become my friends. So as I'm coming across the state of Florida, trying to get into New Orleans, I'm calling these friends of mine who I consider colleagues and friends because of the years that we've been working together. And I'm asking them, where should I put my van, where should I position our crew? Where is going to be a good situation for us to be in to cover this? What is the worst thing that can happen? Everybody's saying flooding, 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 flooding. Don't go to New Orleans, you're going to get stuck. Sit outside New Orleans, wait for the hurricane to come in, then you go in. And we're going, well, There's no way if there's going to be flooding, we're going to be able to go in. So we have to commit ourselves to go in and obviously hope and pray that the water level comes up into an area where we can actually continue to work. So to make a long story short, as we start calling these authorities of where to go, it seemed like they were passing numbers to me from the other district, people who are supposed to be in charge in New Orleans. So I'm going, cool, great, this is perfect. Give me a FEMA number, they gave me a Red Cross number, they gave me all the officials' numbers that I'm supposed to. And no one's answering phones, no one's there. We can't get a hold of anybody. There's no command post. So as, again, I'm crossing now into Mississippi, and I have not made contact with not one official. This is my first red flag, considering that I've been doing hurricanes in Florida. And by now, I would have talked personally to Jeb Bush or anybody, Lieutenant Governor, anyone in Florida. They know who I am, not because I'm a big deal or anything, but it's just the way that I work. I make phone calls. I'm not afraid to call people in charge, especially when I'm putting my life out there and I'm going to be working for a company that depends on me to get the rightful information so we can broadcast it. And when I think, and this has taken a turn in the last couple of years, I'm going to jump around a little bit. I think a lot of networks still cover hurricanes like entertainment, and not because I'm working for NBC, but I think NBC has taken a turn to cover hurricanes as an infomercial. And I say it like that because we're really giving information out that is worth listening to before the hurricane comes. And we used to have a lot of problems with trying to cover a hurricane and putting people out there and making them, oh, here's the wind, and you know, and there's no information really coming out of there, just showing our correspondents getting beat up by the wind, as opposed to telling people, look, you need to get out, these roads are closed, this is what you need to do. And MSNBC this year, I'm proud to say, took the courage to really become the information center, to put out the information that we were getting, and they were like hassling us everywhere we're going. What do you got? What do you see? What streets? Come on, give it to us. Let us have it, because they wanted to put it on the web. They wanted to broadcast this stuff, and it was so bothersome at that time, but we didn't realize how sincere they were about getting information. So when I start telling them, I don't have anything. I can't get a hold of so-and-so, and I don't know where to go. And they're like, come on, you know, this is not you. Or, you know, what's the matter? We'll do it. And then I go, great, here's the number, call. And they're calling me back, and they're going, is that a good number? Because we can't get a hold of anybody. And I'm going, no, that's the number I got. So it became that. It started like that, and that was the first red flag. I just couldn't believe that I was not able to contact anyone. Then the next thing was, covering hurricanes, you know that in some area, there's a staging area where FEMA and the Red Cross, they stage their trucks, and the support and the supplies are going to go into the disaster area. So we, as we're driving across the Panhandle, we're trying to find out from these particular government agencies where they have ice, where do they have the food, where is the Red Cross, where is the help that's going to come in after the storm. Again, we couldn't find it. We must have spent 6 hours. That put me about 4 hours behind the storm now. And I was getting myself in danger. And Heather Allen, the lady who was in charge of the crews in New Orleans, was very worried because now I'm getting out of the range of time to get into New Orleans when it's safe. So because I'm trying to find out where all the supplies are, I get behind in my schedule, and they're worried that I'm not going to make it to New Orleans in time to be safe with the rest of the crew. So again, I called the desk and I go, I don't know what's going on. I feel like I'm in a twilight zone kind of thing. And I wasn't even in New Orleans yet, just getting there. And there's no support. I don't see anything. So we're thinking maybe because they got their you-know-what together, they're going to bring the supplies in from the West Coast. And that's what's happening. And I'm going, brilliant. This is great. They really got it together. They're not going to bring it from the East because maybe this hurricane might take a turn towards the east, and it'll jeopardize everything. So we start making phone calls to the other district, and they're going like, no, we're not doing anything like that. We're not mobilizing anything. Everything is being done out of the East Coast. And we're like, do you know where? And we start getting names like, you might want to call Maine. We're like, Maine? Why Maine? Yeah, you might want to call Chicago. And we're like, Chicago? Are you sure? You understand? And they were serious. and go, okay. And then we start calling these areas, and they're going like, well, we heard that maybe some ice was going to come this way, or we're sending ice from here. No one had one idea of which way or what direction the ice was going to come. I got 10 minutes left. Anyways, as you saw there, that was the best clean video that the network could possibly show. What I videotaped was so unreal that I can't tell you, because I'll cry, and you say we're not supposed to cry when you're...
I didn't say that.
Yes. And I'm still affected by it, and it's just hard. I would love one day to be able to really have the time to tell you how nasty it was, because it gets really, really ugly. And the words that I would have to use, I would have to tell you that if you were recording this and using it for some kind of media outlet, I would have to tell you that to be very careful and keep it into content because of how nasty it was. And that's part of the reason that I'm afraid to use the words that I really want to use, because I'm just afraid that sometimes we use what we say out of content and it's just going to sound like I'm totally against. I'm not here to defend anybody or make any apologies for anybody. I'm here as a guest. I'm a journalist. I'm a freelance cameraman. I'm privileged to work for NBC. I'm not representing them. I truly came here because I was asked to come, and I felt that I needed to do what I'm doing today. But
tell us a little about yourself.
All right. This all started about, and I probably have about 2 minutes.
No,
this all started about 5:30 in the morning. Every morning I get up 5:30 in the morning, get my gear together, make breakfast for 18 people who were my colleagues, the NBC crew, and then I take off and do my rounds. I'm privileged again that I'm allowed to go on my own with my sound tech and what they call go fishing. Just go see what's going on. Find what's happening. Bring it back. Let us know. And then from there, we take an assessment of where we're going to go with the story. So every morning I would go out. And this particular morning, this gentleman, Tyrone Jones, who came out of nowhere, there was a curfew, and no one was allowed to be walking the streets from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Happens to be African-American gentleman, who has now become one of my best friends, came up to me in a rage. You can't imagine, 5 o'clock in the morning, this gentleman sweating. He looked, with all due respect, like if he was on some kind of drugs. He was sweating, just eyes big, ready to eat somebody and kill somebody. He goes, "You gotta talk to me. I need to talk to a journalist." And I'm like, "Whoa, dude, you know, take it easy." You know, he just jumps in my face, 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, "You know, settle down." And he goes, "No, you don't understand." And he goes on about, "You need to come with me today. Your day is with me today. I gotta show you what's going on in the convention center." 4 days, people have been sitting in their wheelchairs full of filth and have not been able to move for 4 days. And I'm going, wow. And children are dying. There's diabetics laying on the floor in the middle of the street. There's dead bodies around the convention center. And he goes on and goes on. All right. I tell one of the engineers, Danny Miller, I said, "Danny, I'm going to get this gentleman." I ask his name. I give Danny Miller, who's an engineer, his name. And I go, "I'm going to the convention center. Please tell Heather Allen," who was the lady in charge, our coordinator, our bureau chief, "that I'm gone with this guy. And if I don't come back in an hour, I got a walkie-talkie. I'm at the convention center." So I take off. There was rumors that there was looting going on and there was shooting going on. And there was, but there was a group of folks that were looting for advantage. And then there was thousands of people who were looting to survive. And of course, sometimes the media doesn't give it dignity and they don't take the time to explain the group that is looting for personal gain and the people who are trying to loot just to survive and get some water for their babies or some milk or some Pampers. And as I go into the convention center with this guy, as you saw in the video, it was an overflow crowd out of the convention center in the streets. And as you walk in there, and I smelled death before and trash and garbage, I just can't tell you the smell that was in the street. It was beyond of death. It was just the stank that it was in my body. I absorbed it. I got so sick, I vomited twice before I actually started rolling video. And I had the vomit on me because it just came out. I'm here with my camera and I'm walking and it just, that's how bad it was. And obviously, this is the stuff that you can't show on TV. So I'm sick to my stomach. And I'm trying to get myself together. And as I walk in, he takes me straight where the dead bodies are. And in my madness, in my dream, you got to imagine, I'm videotaping and I'm trying to absorb as much information because I don't want to be able to come out with video that sounds like it's exaggerated and people are telling me stuff, but I don't have any video to prove it. So every time somebody told me, there's somebody dying, a diabetic is dying, I'm like, okay, fine, tell me that on camera, where is he? And they walk me to this gentleman, and there he is. And as I'm videotaping, the man dies. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a bad dream. And then they go, and there's a baby over here who's about to die. And I go over there, and there's the baby. It's, you know, pale, ready to pass out, dehydrated. The mother grabbing me and just, you need to get us help. You know, this is not about race. It's not about this. It's about, you know, they left us here, and I'm sitting there. I'm totally, like, devastated right now. And then another lady comes from the back, pulls me and says, you want to see the dead babies? And, of course, you're not, you know, you don't even react to it. It's just like a weird situation you're in because you don't want to see it. But then again, you want to see it. And then I just turn around, and she just drags me and takes me where the dead baby is. There's girls who've been raped. You want to see the girls who've been raped? And I'm like, oh, my God, it just doesn't stop. And now I had a problem because when we started getting into this rape stuff, I'm going like, how did this happen? And I had to take the time, and I was just videotaping everything you can imagine as fast as I could and try to make sense of it. So I take the time, I put my camera down, and I tell this lady, you got to explain to me this rape. And she goes, well, these are boys who live in this particular 9th ward, and they know these girls, and they happen to be, you know, acquaintance of each other, and because they've been spending the night, they went after the girls, they forced themselves on the girls, and now the girls are ashamed, they don't want to come out, they feel, you know, bad, and they go, I need to talk to them. Would they talk to me? They go, oh, let's try. We went over there. I think the girls were 13, 14, and I think there was an 11-year-old. I have 3 daughters, so I'm very accurate about this age, and they wouldn't even look at me in the face. They were so buried in shame that I said, you know what? I'll take the shot just so I can have it on video to know who you are. And then I walked away. There was nothing else that I could do because anything after that would have just been prying on a situation that I thought, I'm not going to get anything. All I can do is document that they don't want to talk to me. And then they took me inside the bathrooms. And the bathrooms, when I went inside, I had my waders on that morning because obviously we knew we were going to get into some deep water, so I was ready. There was 2 feet of sewer in the bathrooms, 2 feet. And a gentleman, he must have been 70 years old, 72 years old, this black gentleman, graciously walks in barefooted into the bathroom to the stall and urinates like he's supposed to. I have video of that. And I tell you, if I had a still camera, that would have been an unbelievable shot. And he urinates like he's supposed to. And he goes as far as trying to flush the water. And he walks away. And I'm like, man, that hit me because I saw the kind of people that were there. That really showed me the type of folks that were left behind. And then when I get out and I start hearing more stories and I'm talking, I start seeing, I kind of hallucinated for a while. I start seeing my grandma. I started seeing my family. And that's when it gets really bad because you just start seeing people that remind you of your own, you know, and you're going, gosh, if this was my family and I would be in that crowd, I would have killed somebody that day. I know I would have. Yeah. So for that reason, I just made it more of a point to videotape as much as I could and get as many people as I could. And it seemed like I was there forever, but it really was 45 minutes. And then I ran out of there like a bat out of hell. I was never under any threat. If there was any threat, was that they all wanted to talk to me. For the first time in my career, in a disaster, people wanted to talk to me. I usually have to sit down and beg for people to tell me your story so I can get you help. Please talk to me so we can tell the world. People don't want to talk to you when they're losing their loved ones, when they've lost everything that you can imagine. These people walked miles to the Superdome, and then they were told, you know what, Superdome's full. You need to go to the convention center. And then they walked another 8 blocks to the convention center. And if you see how they were walking, they were in water up to their bellies, carrying their personal belongings in plastic bags, floating it on the water. I mean, the video sets it up, but it just doesn't justify what happened. So it just went on, and it just went on. It didn't stop. So it was like I was in the twilight zone of all the bad things that you can imagine to videotape in one area. I was able to get out of there. Like I said, I was never threatened. Everybody begged me to come back, to please help them, to find them aid, to bring them water. And I had water in my van, and I thought maybe I'll leave my 12-pack of water, but then I can start a riot. I don't want to do that. I said the only thing that I can do is go out, put this video on, and see if someone's listening and they'll come. And that did happen. The video was a very powerful video that made a lot of sense, and it showed a side of the storm that nobody, and this is a weird thing, nobody knew was happening. And like I said, if there was an angel that day, it was Tyrone Jones. And if there's a person who should be sitting here talking, it should be him. Because it was him that took the courage to walk in curfew, a black man, in the middle of a disaster when they were being shot, if you even looked like you were looting. And they weren't being shot at, but they were being shot to keep people away from the streets. We saw that. I can't tell you that they were being directly shot at, but they were being fired upon to keep people from coming into the business area. And he took the chance, and he came out and got me, took me there, and I think he's the angel of this disaster. Thank you.